This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Liz Winstead is funny for a living. She travels the country doing stand-up comedy at clubs and conferences, and she has an edge. In the spirit of Lenny Bruce and George Carlin, Liz uses humor to pry into the hidden spaces of American culture. Her critical view of culture and politics helped make The Daily Show an enormous success, and her off-the-cuff commentary helped launch Air America Radio Network. She brings her keen wit to the Cat's Cradle in Carrboro tonight, but first joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Do you see yourself in that line with George Carlin?
I mean, I would never. That's like saying, do you think you're gorgeous just like Angelina Jolie? You know, I can't. I could never put myself there. I hope that I'm in the spirit of George Carlin, where I look at the absurdities of the world and then try to, through my own absurdity, try to point it out, make sense of it, ask questions about it.
Questions. That's an important part of your work.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I am more of a troublemaker and a rabble rouser than I am somebody who you should listen to actually continue your news path and thought forming. And so if I can, through reading and watching and observing, ask questions about the hypocrisy that I see and get people laughing, hopefully then they'll ask questions. So that is kind of the plan.
Your book is called Liz Free or Die. It's coming out next month. Personal book, essays about your journey to comedy.
Yeah, and beyond. And it was like, it's a fun little read because it's sort of a mini memoir, I guess, is that they are essays that are chronological, but I've left out certain hunks. You know, like when you write a memoir, everyone says, did you write about this? And I was like, no, I didn't. But yeah, there's some fun and interesting places that I've gone. And I waited a long time to write it to make sure that I had sort of some perspective on each of the big things that I've done and also some big things that I've gone through that I think a lot of people have, but no one really talks about it that much.
Well, and you talk about your origins, too, being in Catholic school.
Yeah.
Where questions not always welcome.
Not always welcome. You know, I was one of those little kids who, as a young girl, I just wasn't particularly interested in all young girl things in the 1960s. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I was more of a tomboy, I guess. And so when somebody gave me a baby doll as a toy, and the one thing the doll did was pee when you gave it water, and that was all it did, I was like, this seems suspect. And now, and then all of a sudden you're giving me a washing machine as a toy. And I was like, are these really games? Because this really seems like training for something I really don't have plans to do ever in the future. And, you know, why don't you just say, oh, we're going to play Here's Your Drunk of a Husband laying on the couch, too, honey, just to get the whole perspective of maybe what things could be. And so I was like, I don't think I dig this. And so as I just pushed back a little bit with just simple questions like, well, what if I don't want to do that? It was like, well, what do you mean? Why wouldn't you want to do that? It's a perfectly lovely thing to do. And it's like, yeah, you seem to really like it. But for some reason, I don't connect. And so, for example, when I wanted to earn a little money and babysitting wasn't my path, I one day was in church and I watched those altar boys. And I was like, oh, they get paid money to do weddings and funerals. I'm just going to go tell the priest that I would like to be an altar boy. And so when I set up my big meeting with the priest, and I said, I would like to be an altar boy. He looked at me and his mouth was agape and he had one of those looks on his face, you know, that adults did when they're desperately trying to pull something out of their patoot. And so he said, you can't be an altar boy because it's called altar boy. And even at 12, I was like, well, you could just call it altar girl if I did it. And he was like, well, yeah, but, and I was like, I'm not have to carry anvils. I can hold a chalice. I can put on that frock. You know, yeah. I'd be super good
at it. You probably look better in that than most of the guys in.
Totally. Yeah. And so he had me write a letter to the archbishop to pass the buck, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so I did. And then years later found out from my mother that our archbishop kind of had a love of the drink. And in fact, was busted for driving into the wall of a 7-Eleven during Lent, which was an unfortunate problem.
Yeah.
So everybody knew that, all the adults knew that if somebody says write a letter to the archbishop, that letter ain't going anywhere. You know.
The real scandal was that he'd given up Slurpees.
He'd given up Slurpees
and
for Lent.
Clearly,
yes.
He was outed on that.
Yes.
I'm still stuck on the picture of drunk Ken. But isn't it freakish, or did you consider it freakish, or do you now that you actually looked at a toy and a gift and began to suspect that you were in training? I mean, that's young for being
able
to
figure
that out.
Well, you know, what it was just this repetitive pattern that was little kid versions of what my mom was doing, not for fun, but as a chore. Right. My mom was not like, oh, my God, I'm so happy my life's work is taking the curtains down and ironing them and doing the laundry for the dad and trying to figure out what to make you kids. You know, I was the youngest of five kids. So that wasn't the part that she was embracing. But yet that was the part they were selling me on in plastic Mattel form. So I felt like something's up, you know, and even though I could make a cake with a 40 watt light bulb. Just something I didn't want to do every day.
No real sense of accomplishment there.
Right.
So it's got to be tough for you as a satirist these days. I was just thinking about it. I mean, I read the headlines and I think I'm reading The Onion. Oh, no, it's the New York Times.
Exactly. Oh, boy. It's what it is for a satirist these days now is when you come to my show, I open every show by saying, when you come and see me, it's sort of like going to see the Rolling Stones. I'm not going to get to all the hits because there are just so many. I mean, I could do a whole one-person show about just Mitt Romney alone or Rick Santorum alone or certainly Michelle Bachmann alone. But you have to like sort of take the greatest hits of all of this and put it out there. And it's been a very interesting road to watch social networking with the whole Ann Romney comments of yesterday and being somebody who just has a book coming out about I had a different path and that motherhood didn't happen to be for me. And now there's this debate and engagement about whether or not, you know, Hillary Rosen was right to criticize Ann Romney for saying she never worked a day in her life, which I don't think that's what she meant. Obviously, when you raise five kids, I watched my own mother. It seems like a hellish nightmare, especially when the five kids have the DNA of the Winstead children. And so I think Ann Romney is probably a wonderful mother. That doesn't mean she's Paul Krugman. And I think it's fair to say you are a very fortunate woman who has, you know, surpassed incredible odds. She survived cancer. She's living with MS, has five kids. That's all incredible. What's weird is when Mitt Romney says, when Ann talks to the women out there, it's like, honey, why aren't you talking to the women out there? Like, this is the fundamental, yet again, another disconnect that comes from the Romney household. A friend of mine who grew up in Boston reminded me last night, she was like, I remember driving my car in Boston and Ann Romney was on the radio and said, you know, college was hard for Mitt and I. We had to sell some of our stocks. And I was like, I had to sell blood and I think pot, maybe. I'm not sure. Right. But, you know, it's like the disconnect, I think, is what people react to. Yeah. You know, when you got Mitt Romney and his lady wranglers trying to connect, it's like, oh, honey.
Well, what about, it seems to me, too, that now that he's the sort of presumptive candidate for the Republicans, a lot of the really funniest candidates have dropped out. Kind of sad, isn't it?
Well, you know, yeah. And I noticed after Rick Santorum dropped out that all of the people that apparently God endorsed are out of the race. So I think God finally has said, you guys need to drop out because I do believe in birth control because I can't have many more of you walking around speaking in my name. It's insanity. You're giving me a really bad rap.
But President Obama, what are some questions that you would ask him, probing questions that would lead us to?
I think what I would ask President Obama, one of the things I would ask him is, you know, I mean, there are certainly things I have problems with, like, you know, the healthcare bill had a lot of problems that I disagreed with, certainly. You know, why are we still in Afghanistan? Why is Guantanamo still open? You know, why is it that you constantly try to compromise with people who seem to not want to compromise with you at all? I mean, sometimes I think if President Obama was the protagonist in The Lord of the Rings, it wouldn't have been a trilogy. It might have been a leaflet. Like, the second he met an orc, he'd be like, okay, let's sit down. Let's sit down and you and I have a conversation. Please don't chew off my arm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems a little bit kooky. You know, it's not the party, the Republican Party of old that my dad belonged to. We used to have great fights, my father and I, about you know, philosophy. But it didn't go from the ridiculous to the sublime. He wouldn't support somebody who said there's at least 70 now, between 79 and 81 communists in the House of Representatives right now. It's like, really? There's only 2,000 people in the entire United States Communist Party. So you're saying that around 5% of them are all holding public office. That's an incredible Incredible statement.
It's a very successful party.
Wow, they're doing quite well. Who knew?
Well, the discourse itself has gotten, I mean, I think you just put your finger on it. There was a time when people used to love to sit down with their antagonist on the other side and really have these debates. It feels like we can't do that. It moves to homicide far too quickly.
It does. It moves to this crazy attrition. And I really don't know. When I look at how moderation has been pushed out of the Republican Party, certainly, that the people who I think, like Olympia Snowe or Kay Bailey Hutchinson or you know, people who have like strong moral convictions that I might disagree with, but I think are statesmen and have leadership and skills, were not candidates this year. When, I mean, if I was a Republican, I would feel bad because I look at these people and I think, where did you come from? Like having to choose is sort of like saying, I've got a, which package of spoiled meat might be okay to eat? I feel bad for someone who has to choose.
Does that come down to this perceived inversion in politics where at one time you tried to promote a candidate who represented the point of view of the most party members, and now all you have to do is be against the opposition? So all you have to do is be against Barack Obama, and it doesn't really matter who's for, you know, who is the Republican candidate.
You know, I think a lot of times, you know, when I was trying to look back at my own life, and I turned 50 this year, and I think there's been two people maybe in my entire life that I voted for and that I was really excited about and that it wasn't what you said. But I think it has escalated quite a bit to when, you know, when the economy is so crazy and you look at North Carolina, I mean, it's like your unemployment, you guys are 47th, you know, and this Amendment 1 thing is the priority. It just seems crazy that gay rights is the priority and you know, women's health care is a priority. It's like my uterus has never created a job. In fact, I'm 50. It doesn't even do the job it's supposed to do anymore. So really, I wish we would stop focusing on things that don't help the greater good and start really looking at, you know, getting things back to work on some level.
What about Amendment 1? Here's a state that's about to pass a constitutional amendment that does what the law does, but I guess it goes a little bit farther. It could be a lot.
Do you state. Think it will pass here?
You know, the polls at the moment, but who knows?
I just don't understand. This is what I've never understood, and maybe it is because I grew up this little kid who, when I just looked at the norms of, and I didn't want to do it. So when I met, you know, gay folks along the way or people of color along the way, and they're like, you know, I can't go there because I'm black, or I can't do that because I'm gay. And I was like, really? So what I don't understand is how your marriage is somehow in jeopardy when two people you don't know who live in a town or a state that you probably will never go to have a happy life, how that affects you and how you are so riddled with making sure that other forms of people finding ways to live together and having relationships is threatening you. I'm not sure you should be the one that can get married. It kind of feels a little bit nutty to me.
Liz, if gay people are allowed to get married, my children will not have been born. Don't you understand that? And
clearly.
And
yes.
It's just a matter of time before I start having sex with goats.
You know what? Here's the truth about gay folks getting married. Every one of my gay friends who got married just became just like all my straight friends. They moved to the suburbs and complained that they don't have enough sex. It is absolutely no different than anything else in any straight marriage that I've ever come across.
It is a strange thing, too, because when you go into the ballot box, you wonder what question you think you're answering. Are you answering, you know, is it more like you to be a man and a woman? Well, that's one way to vote. And then there's another one. Should people who are citizens of the United States be denied the same right that you had? Now, that's another way to ask the very question that's on this amendment. And it does seem to me that that's part of the trouble in even the politics around this.
Well, and I just to me, it's always troubling when so many people that I know who are in loving relationships, whether they're a man and a woman who choose not to get married, whether they're same-sex couples, who the pain that same-sex couples go through just not being able to, you know, have a marriage that is, you know, saying that society says, we honor you and we honor this relationship that you have. I became a minister in New York when they allowed gay marriage in New York, and I've married a gay couple. It's fun. You know, it's just somebody who's been together 15 years who couldn't wait. And it's really a great emotional bond. And so I hope that people realize that denying people's rights does not make your marriage any better.
We talked about questions, and asking the big question is one of the ways in which you can shine light on these sort of the dark corners of culture. Is the question the thing? Do you need an answer? Do you want to provoke an answer?
Sometimes I just want to provoke more conversation. And I think what's great about humor is if you don't act like a know-it-all, then people are okay with you asking some questions. And if you can make people laugh, they can't deny that you just had a connection. It's like, oh, I'm supposed to hate that person and they just made me laugh and now I'm screwed. I kind of like you. And so I think putting a face on it and bringing some humor to it and saying, you know what, here's a crazy question. Let's throw it out there and have people keep talking about it.
Have you ever run up against a topic or particularly a headline, something in the news that you just felt was off limits?
For me, off limits means I don't know enough to point out some irony or some something that can, you know, I can use for fodder. I don't think anything's off limits. I think that, you know, if you look at something, you know, big, whether it's 9/11 or whether it's some other thing, you know, who are you talking about? I like to look at a concept and say, who is the bad guy? Who are the people being sort of affected by the bad guy's behavior, and then take on the bad guy. So if you can look at a bad guy and point out at him and point out the hypocrisy of that person, that's usually in anything. And if it's making the news and I can bring it up and figure that out, then I do.
Yeah, the hypocrisy, I think, is the thing. That's where you can always find humor, because there's this pomposity of the statement and how it represents all the good, and then you just kind of turn that on its side.
And politics never lets you down with hypocrisy, and that's the good news. Yeah. You know, it's like I just look at, you know, as things roll out and, you know, we have Citizens United and we have these cases where, you know, people are actually saying corporations are people, and it's like, oh, my God, if corporations are people, we need Planned Parenthood more than ever. I got to be honest. That should be one big proponent for Planned Parenthood.
Well, and a lot bigger jails, because there are some corporations headquartered right here in this state that need to just go to jail for the felonies they've already admitted.
I could not agree more. It is crazy. I'm watching this healthcare debate go on and Scalia. Sometimes I'm like, does he have a bathrobe on under his robe just so we can go immediately from the chamber to screaming at kids on his lawn? Because he really is an unpleasant human being.
Supreme Court is that's a funny group.
They are a funny group. They seem... And when you see the polls, it's disheartening how many Americans don't really feel like they are going to look at a case in total. And, you know, when you see Scalia saying, oh, well, the bill is 2,700 pages and I got to read it. And it's like, excuse me, sir, if reading things and writing things is a pain in the butt for you, maybe the Supreme Court's not your bag. I don't know.
Get back to the lawn and scream at the kids.
What else are you supposed to be doing?
Yeah. Is that it, too? Do you think we've become so cynical about these institutions? We don't even expect the Supreme Court to act fairly, that if you've been a lawyer for Monsanto, when that case comes to you, we know how that one's going to come out.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think we have become so cynical. When you see somebody defending every single thing because somebody... Think, you know, if you're defending George Zimmerman, you're defending pink slime, which, you know, it's like, what are you talking? Food should not look like a hate crime. Can I just put that out there and just be completely crazy? But it or look like it's a joint compound. Like, those things should not happen. We should not serve that to our kids. You know, when you're legislating pizza as a vegetable, after a while, how do you not become cynical? And so I feel like I step in and say, before we leap off the bridge, let's all get together in a room and laugh and know that we're at least in it together and we are all showing that we are sane.
Liz, at least we can still laugh about it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Thanks for being here again. Liz Winstead, her new book, Liz Free or Die, is going to be out next month. She's going to appear tonight, Cat's Cradle in Carrboro, 8 o'clock. For more information, go to LizWinstead.com. Liz is spelled with two Z's. You can also go to CatsCradle.com to find out more about her upcoming visit. That's tonight. Coming up on this show, the saxophone stylings of Brian Horton. Stay with us on The State of Things.